What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine, the podcast hosted by me, Ken Levine. This is part two of my interview with my writing partner, David Isaacs. If you missed part one, after you listen to this one, go back, because there's a lot of really neat stuff. In that episode, we talk about breaking in, about writing separately, our goals, and also his side of the prank that I pulled on him. That was last week, and this week we continue our conversation. We talk about the value of outlines. We talk about some mistakes that we very candidly made in our career and the lessons that we learned as a result. We get into casting, we get into directing, and also David spent a year working on Mad Men, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So part two of my interview with David Isaacs coming up right now. Do you need a very detailed outline?
I always try to get as much into it as I possibly can. I just am a firm believer, as I know you are, of sometimes experimentation is fun, and you say, well, I'm just going to go off and see what I'm doing. But if it's certainly for something where I'm being paid, or it's something that I've been thinking about for a long time, I'm going to want to have a real map of where I'm going with this thing, and especially where I want to end up. That, mm-hmm. to me, is very, very important. Even if it's not the place I ultimately end, I want to have a destination and then a pathway to that destination. That to me is what an outline is.
You know, an outline, I find, especially for a screenplay, is really important, because, mm-hmm. you know, you only have so much time, and you need to do certain things, and you need to get to certain points
right.
in a screenplay. And if you know you need a section where the couple has to fall in love, let's say, okay, well, if you know you only have 5 pages to establish that, you're going to come up with a different way of telling that story than if you have 10 pages to tell that.
Mm-hmm.
And you won't know whether you need 5 or 10 pages unless you outline and see what else is there. And you need to get a good idea of, well, they should be falling in love like 20 minutes into the movie, and we're an hour in already.
Right, right. Well, it's a rule of thumb. And the other thing I use when I tell students about outlining and how important it is, the simple metaphor, the simple analogy of why we're doing this is, would you go into a dense forest, a large dense forest, without a map or a compass? Or would you cross a body of water, a large body of water, in some vessel without a compass or a way to know where true north was? You're crazy if you don't.
I know Neil Simon never would outline, and he would have an idea and just start writing. Writing the outline and coming up with the story and the story beats is the hardest part of the process. And you figure, wow, that sounds great, until you hear the other part, which is, he said he had a drawer full of 30-page plays that just ended
because he hit a roadblock and didn't know how to fix it. So, you know, there was all this extra work that was done, all of these half-baked plays that never came to fruition.
That's fine if you're Neil Simon.
Uh-huh.
Or it's probably the old joke, one day his mom and dad sat him and his brother Danny down and said, which of you wants to be Neil Simon?
Yeah.
You know, it was an old joke, but he was a master and he was talented, and he had years of running heavy equipment, as they say, so he could experiment. But boy, if you're starting out, you're going to wander around forever unless you have a map of where you're going.
Can you watch our old MASH episodes and thoroughly enjoy them?
No. No. No.
I'm the same way. There's like maybe three that I can still watch.
Yeah.
The rest is like, give me one more day.
Oh, I can't tell you. They're playing everywhere now, so I'll run into them from time to time. And you can go almost anywhere across it, the Me Channel and Sundance and God knows, you know.
They're on Black Entertainment Television. They're everywhere now.
They're everywhere. Yeah. But when I do sit and watch the ones we wrote, I'm like, yeah, let me have one more shot. we could do so much better with that, or even the way we told the story, things like that. Whereas I'll watch the early ones that Gail Barn and Gene Reynolds, you know, did, and I'll go, God, those were good. You
uh-huh.
know? And they still hold up, and they're amazing. But, you know, you're tougher on your own stuff.
You know, I never had a chance to ask Larry Gelbart, whether he was able to watch those first 4 years. Because he might have watched those episodes and said the same thing that you and I are saying.
It could be. It could be. But, you know, for me, it's like if you're a musician, you go to Mozart and go, what'd you really think about your work? I mean, he's at a level that few, I think, were writing at. And of course, that's my opinion of Larry. But I'm sure he had his own doubts from time to time.
Right.
But there got to be times where he just sat down and go, damn, I'm good.
When we were on Cheers, we're in the room with some amazing joke guys.
Right.
And to me, there was nobody better than Glenn Charles.
Mm-hmm.
And I would listen to him pitch out a joke, mm-hmm. a brilliant joke, and then I would try to go back and figure the thought process of how A led to B, led to C, led to D. And that was really kind of, for me, a course in joke writing. Did you do that? How did you
I don't know how you felt, but our first year on Cheers was a real eye-opener for me in terms of how little I knew. And I'm sitting there with the Charles brothers, who, on top of being incredibly great comedy writers, were incredibly literate men as well. So their depth of knowledge, I felt, was far greater than me. And then, of course, David Lloyd, who was one of the great, great wits, and Jerry Belson. And it was pretty daunting right away for me. I was more cowed by it, I think, than you were. And what worked for me was sheer osmosis. I think years of then sitting, writing those Cheerses and being in their company and hearing it again and again overcame my doubts about myself to the point where maybe that's the old 10,000 hours or something,
mm-hmm.
where I just literally, it kind of started to make sense to me. I don't think I broke it down quite in the same way because I was more in awe of it. I know you were too.
Yeah.
We both were.
Yeah.
We would both look at each other and go, where did that come from? Because he would literally, remember how he would be sitting at his desk and he would just like explode back in his chair.
Right.
And
have a little laugh.
And laugh.
And you go, and it here it comes.
Here it comes. And it would be great and we'd all be laughing. And that would be the solution or the joke. So to me, it was alchemy, but it is a fact. You know, once again, I say this to the student, the fact that I hung in there and went through all the negativity about myself or the sort of inability to be able to imitate that or at any level or be able to kind of walk in one day and do it, it just was a matter of staying with it. And then two, three years later, I think I got it.
You know, I never got tired of writing episodes of Cheers.
No, me neither. That I loved.
Yeah, it was 40 episodes of Cheers that we wrote. We wrote, I think, 19 or 20 MASHes, and by the time we left MASH, I was ready.
Yeah.
You know, it seemed like there was every hot show, every cold show, every visiting general, everyone had slept with everyone else. But for whatever reason, the characters and the situations on Cheers, I always felt those characters were really fresh. And one of my favorite episodes, ironically, is the one that was experimental. We went into Glenn and Les, and this is, I believe, the sixth or seventh season, something like that. I remember, because Rebecca was there.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm going to say the sixth season.
Yeah. And we had an idea. Frasier was engaged to be married to Lilith, and we thought, what if we do a bachelor party show, but, you know, Cheers spent a lot of time sprinkling in bar talk, where the guys would just get off on a conversation, what is the sweatiest movie, that sort of thing. And thought, wouldn't it be interesting to do a pretty free-form episode where there's just a lot of bar talk, and the only story is that Frasier begins to have doubts as to whether or not he should get married, and by the end of the show decides, yeah, I'm going to go through with it. That was it. That was the only plot. And I remember you and I went to Glenn and Les and proposed this, and they said, okay, do it. Mm-hmm. And it was really fun. I was happy to get back to Outlines, the next one, but it was really fun, and I'm really happy with how that episode came out.
Once again, I guess I bring up the disclaimer of don't try to do this at home.
Right, yeah.
Kind of stuff.
Yeah, we had written 30 by this time.
But I got to say, pound for pound of all the 40 we wrote, and I'm proud of all of them, and some we were nominated for awards with, Frasier's Bachelor Party is my favorite episode that we wrote to this day.
Yeah.
I just love that episode. It has lines that just, I hear them again, and I'm like, wow, that's funny, and just the whole story and everything, the way it worked and the way the guys, it was a kind of guys show, and even though we had all the women in the show at Lilith's bachelorette party,
right,
and those things kind of gelled at the end of the show because you have to have some kind of denouement, but I just love that episode.
You know, the other thing I think it taught me was that, going back to Don't Try This at Home, we had been doing it long enough that we both have kind of an inner clock.
Yeah.
So we both knew when, okay, it's time to move this along.
Right.
It's time to go on to something else.
Yeah.
We can't spend seven pages with everybody talking about how they lost their virginity.
No, you still have to tell a story.
Right.
And you still have to have things move forward in the story so that we need it. But we had that. We had that, I think, innately in our DNA. So, or we had learned how to do that. So when we needed to do that, we did it, you know. And we had enough story that we could kind of hit on those moments.
Okay, so an important lesson that we learned was we left Cheers for a year or so to create a series for Mary Tyler Moore. And I've talked about this a little bit in the past.
Bring back some of those great old days.
Great old days. Let's just say it was difficult and it was disappointing. But one of the big mistakes, and there were a lot of mistakes that you could dole out everywhere, but one of the biggest mistakes was a mistake that we made by not sticking to our guns. And by that, you and I came up with a premise for the show, and our original premise was that it was going to be set in like a tabloid newspaper, but that Mary was going to be the editor, and that her ex-husband, who is kind of a Cary Grant, because we were sort of thinking front page, you know, His Girl Friday. But we thought, okay, that's going to be different, and it will give Mary a chance to play a very different character than we've seen her before. We went and we pitched that to CBS, and they hated it. They said, no, no, people are not going to accept Mary Tyler Moore as the boss. They're not going to like her. You have to come up with something where she's a little bit more likable. And so we twisted the idea around where she was a high fashion journalist having to go to work at a tabloid, and that her boss, the editor, was the Cary Grant type of scoundrel where you didn't know whether he was actually just pushing her for her own good or he was a sleazeball. And it wasn't as good, and I think the show would have been so much better, and Mary probably would have been so much happier to play a role where she was in control as opposed to a role where she was sort of playing an extension of the Mary Richards character. And I kick ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, we were young at the time. If it were today, we would say no.
Yeah.
No, we don't want to do that.
Let's just say it. We were seduced by the fact of having a major star and of course, you know, 13 on the Air and all the other wonderful things that came with it. I would agree with you. We made many mistakes. And I would go beyond that to say that was the mistake.
That was the fatal flaw.
Because at least what I think, and this is hindsight, of course, but what I think our instincts were, and instinct is a very important word for a writer, what our instinct was to move that woman, the character she had played in Mary, not Mary Richards herself, but the woman herself, from a woman who was finding herself in business and in life to a person who had some success and what is the price of success in some ways. What we did was we took that character and we sort of made her a failure, mm-hmm. and having to maintain her dignity in a sort of lesser place than JM was. So we made a fatal structural narrative flaw by putting her in a situation where she was kind of treading water.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'm saying this looking back on it, but the lesson we learned, and the lesson was a big lesson for us to learn, and we paid a big price to learn it. We made a big psychic price to learn it, was that if you must go with your own instincts, don't let yourself be talked out of it by people who are not going to be doing the writing and who are guessing at what is going to work, as opposed to you being there, doing it every day. You're the one that has to write it. You're the one that has to live and die with it. And from that, we learned if we don't feel what we're doing is right, there's no point in doing it.
Yeah.
For the money, or for the prestige or the fame or whatever.
It's a lesson that we should have learned earlier, because our first pilot that we also produced was a pilot for NBC. And I had read a great book called Something Wonderful Right Away by Jeffrey Sweet, which was about the beginning of improv in Chicago in the 50s, the Compass Players, and eventually Second City, et cetera, et cetera. And that led to Mike Nichols and Elaine May teaming up. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to do a series about a Nichols and May type of relationship? These two people that worked together, and also this was before When Harry Met Sally, I thought it'd be kind of interesting, can a couple that are attracted to each other be friends and not lovers? Anyway, that's what we went into with NBC. And they liked the idea, but they liked the idea because they had read a book called Semi-Tough, and they wanted to do a series about a love triangle. So they said to us, well, we can kind of work that in. What if she has a boyfriend? And then we have this triangle situation. And again, what we should have said was, no, that's not the series. Those are not the stories that we're telling. But, you know, we were young and it was our first pilot. And we said, okay, it was a bitch to write because the Mike Nichols character was never a threat.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you have this idiotic triangle where the guy is never a threat. What the hell are we doing?
Right. We made a lot of rookie mistakes.
Right.
On that one. And, but that's the point. You learn. You learn how to not only write them, but to produce them and do them well and cast them, which is the key.
Now, you have a very keen eye for casting. What are some of the things that you look for in casting? No, you really do.
Well, if you're doing comedy, are they funny?
Uh-huh.
Are these people, the people that you're reading, find funny people?
By the way, this is not something that the network is concerned with. Are they beautiful?
Yeah.
That's what they're going to be.
Attractiveness is really their number one, or charisma, I suppose, is their number one criterion. And my feeling is, boy, go out and find people who hopefully are attractive and funny, but number one, funny. I mean, Seinfeld is the perfect example of knowing what you're looking for in casting. They always found the funniest people, not the best looking people.
Right.
Not, you wouldn't look at that show and go, boy, was that a beautiful cast, or were all the girls that Jerry dated were all beautiful. But at the same time, Larry and Jerry were able to kind of give them quirks that made their beauty secondary to who they were. That's the number one thing I look for. And of course, to me, is if a character is not trying, if actors try not to be, they're not trying to be funny, they're naturally
right. They don't reactive. Know. They don't know they're in a comedy.
They don't know they're in a comedy.
Yeah.
That's something you don't find a lot. You have to find those actors are, especially men in sitcom. That's why Ted Danson to this day was the great, I'll bend a metaphor here and go, was the Wyatt Earp of light comedy. The greatest lawman, the best lawman that ever walked the West.
Uh-huh.
He just again and again and again proved that he knew how to do light comedy, and why weren't there more guys like that and like Ted?
It's hard. Yeah. And generally, if you are really good looking and good with light comedy, you wind up in movies really quick.
To me, a good yardstick was always how fast in a scene would an actor or an actress go to anger?
Uh-huh.
The more they could delay out and out anger, the better the comic actor they were. That's something I learned, I think, watching Ted and watching Shelley and watching those people constantly again and again. Certainly on Frasier, you watch masterfully their ability to be in conflict but not go immediately to being angry.
One of the things that I feel you and I were so fortunate in our career is that throughout our career, we got to write for some of the greatest actors of their age. And it was incredible. It was just such a privilege to write for people like David Hyde Pierce and Kelsey Grammer and Ted Danson and Shelley Long and Alan Alda and Tom Hanks and on and on and on, Nancy Travis, and I could just go on and on. But boy, they made us look good, didn't they?
you know, it was a breakthrough for me. I think you were the first, if you remember this, you pointed this out, and it made perfect sense to me because I couldn't quite put my finger on why I was enjoying it so much. But the first MASH that we wrote, when we went to see Gene Reynolds direct it,
right,
and we saw the scene, and it was so much better than we had written it. I mean, it was more than I expected
from
it.
Right.
And you pointed out, I remember, that say, It's because Alan is so, it's like he's doing something we didn't even give him credit for doing in the scene. We were writing his lines, but we didn't know what he was going to be doing physically or the expression on his face. And it's like, look how much better that is because he's playing Hawkeye. And I remember thinking, going, yeah, you're right. It's like, wow, it's so much better because of him. So that was the gift that we were given in beyond the fact that we had a very nice career and success, relative success, was the people that we got to write for. It was just, that was just, you know, we shouldn't have been as lucky as we were. We weren't that nice. We determined.
No, there's a lot of very good writers.
We're allowed to be that lucky.
A lot of very good writers who had to write for Alex Karras. So, we were very fortunate.
May he rest in peace. Without CTE, I suppose.
Okay. When you write, what do you picture? Do you picture it on the air? Do you picture the filming of the show? What are you picturing? Anything?
I'm usually picturing, for me, the scene itself. I don't have your eye for where the camera should be. I'm not artistic that way. I'm not underselling myself. I'm just not. I don't have that gene. So I'm kind of like in a general sense of what's going on and where the characters in proximity to each other. But I'm not sort of picturing it fully formed.
I picture it on the air. I picture...
Wow.
I picture watching it. Well, that helps me think of the characters as the characters and not the actors. So it allows me to think this is Sam and Diane.
Well, now I know.
It's not Ted and Shelley.
Now I know why we're so good, because you were directing it while we were writing it. that makes perfect sense why we were such a good team.
You never had any desire to direct?
No. I just knew I could do this one thing. And to answer questions about it, you know, my joke is on any given day, I like to answer 3 or 4 questions tops.
That's right. In fact, this is a whole month. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's taken up a whole month.
Watching you direct, watching anyone direct, I'm just struck by how much detail goes into from the page to the stage. It's an undertaking that is completely different than the writing, because now you're out there on a wire. You know, you're controlling it when you're writing it. But when you're bringing it onto the stage, there's a lot of things you didn't see. Or you also have to explore the space. What do we have here that we can use, that we can add to? I just don't have that eye. I know I don't. And I just didn't. I mean, I think I could talk to actors in terms of what we want from the scene. But the getting there, that to me takes a certain amount of... I can see this. And so that makes perfect sense of what you said about yourself, that you moved so nicely into directing.
Okay, you moved on, and both of us were friends with Matthew Weiner. Mm-hmm. We both worked with him on Becker. And then he goes off and does Mad Men, and it's season 2, and I'm doing Dodger Talk full time. And you get a call from Matt to work on Mad Men. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about what it was like working on Mad Men.
Wow, that's a you could talk about it for a long time. To just be as brief as I can be and get some anecdotal stuff in there. It was a new experience for me. I had never... While I was very confident that we understood how to write dramatic moments because we had worked on MASH and we understood how the comedy or the situation earned you the right to have a dramatic moment, that I understood. But to be fully dramatic for 60 minutes or for, you know, 48 minutes with commercials, that was different for me in terms of laying out the scenes and how scenes didn't have to necessarily deliver jokes as much as they had to deliver intent and the bigger, deeper sense of the character's journey. Matt is a masterful artist when it comes to the world he created, or he's created in other ways. And so I watched him quite a bit, even though he wasn't always around. I took to it, I think, fairly well. For me, it was tough because I'd never been on anything that was so, the word I use is authored, where it really is like a novel, like your the detail mm-hmm. and the character arc and the, you know, I'm tend to work in closed episodes that are done and then you move on to the next episode. There's very little, there's sort of ongoing story and ongoing relationships going on as they were in Cheers.
Right.
But there's not
plot. The more of the serialized
yeah, there's not plot yeah. movement on a big level. And watching him and seeing how he was laying out the season, because he knew at the end of that season that it was going to end Don Draper's journey at that to that point was going to be to the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And right. This was season two, I believe,
season
right?
Two. Mm-hmm. And the sort of existential meaning of all of that and how it reflected into Don's life and how suddenly the very life you had built as an adult and the family and the business and all the things you had done could come to an end like that because people in places you would never go could suddenly be throwing missiles at each other. And it was all... It turns meaning on its ear. And that's where he was going with it. And that's where Don's life was going to go. His marriage is going to start to break up. Sterling Cooper is going to be sold. All of those things are events that lead you to a moment of existential crisis for Don.
Okay.
And that was the season I worked on. And I worked with some incredibly great writers. Marty Noxon, who's just an absolute dynamo of story and originality, and Maria Jacquemartin and her husband, André Jacquemartin, who are great, great hour craftsmen, and Lisa Albert, who was wonderful, and Robin Veith. I mean, it was just a very great group. Strange enough, you hear it was mostly women. So it was the first time I worked in that atmosphere, and I loved it. What I learned was really the deeper storytelling. I think that's what I got out of it that late in my life and that late in my career. And I think it's led me to certainly helped me in the new career I have, which is teaching. But also, I think as a writer, it was a great, great experience. It was tough. It's hard to work with someone. I'll be very frank. It's hard to work with someone who is, in a sense, really needs no other people to kind of to get him where he needs to go. That's not to diminish anybody, because they were all, he would tell you that they were all very valuable to him. But it's hard to kind of, you either can work into someone's mind that way or you can't. And I found myself not able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for me,
because
it was a
you're
kind
not
of,
writing what you think something should be. You're writing what you suppose someone else is thinking.
Right, yeah. Right. And it's on such a deep level that you have to really work at it. You really have to. Maybe the second year, if I'd come back, I would have been better. But for me, it was just a little bit too existential. Uh-huh. Strangely enough, if you want to say there was a theme to it for me, too.
Well, David, this is great. Thanks much.
My pleasure.
Have you on again.
Great. Thanks for
it's really hard to get him, by the yeah. way. This is, yeah. you know, the hardest guest I have. It's like, yeah. what is this podcast? Who? How many people are going to yeah. listen to this? Yeah. Do I make any money?
I need to, at this point in my life, it really has to pay off for me.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah. You know, I had to call his agent, you know, who's my agent.
When you play this, do I get residuals for...
Yeah, yeah. If somebody listens to this episode 17 times, you get a nickel.
Okay. See, this is the kind of honesty that keeps you writing with the same person for 40 years.
That's right, and it's why I do podcasts. Thanks, bud.
Take care, man.
And there you have it. That is my interview with David Isaacs, comedy writer. Thanks so much to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, as always, and to Howard Hoffman and John Wolfert. If you want to get in touch with me, I do have an email address, hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. Again, that is hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @KenLevine. Also, I am on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. Please subscribe. Please give me a 5-star review. I know, I'm just, you know, I'm asking so much of you people. Anyway, thanks so much for listening, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
Hollywood and Levine.